very long trip in Europe. And so I'm going to talk about time in this talk and the problems that time poses to fundamental physics. I'm not going to feed you answers for the first part of my talk. I'm just going to try to explain you what are the problems that arise when you try to put together two notions of time that come from different areas of physics. After going through an overview of all these problems, which is by no means complete, there's many facets and many more things that I will skip, because I just want to concentrate on the things in which I believe I have something to say about. After that, I will talk about the theory I'm working on, which is called shape dynamics, which proposes some solutions to these problems. And I will really concentrate just to the recent work that I've been doing on the arrow of the problem of the arrow of time, which is one of these faces of the problem of time, together in collaboration with Julian Barbour and Tim Kozlowski. These are the papers. So this is a list of the particular aspects of the problem of time that I'm going to talk about. First, as I told you, there is a problem when you put together two different notions of time. And for me, the most evident one is the one that arises when you put together the notion of time that you have in general relativity with the one that is at the basis of quantum field theory. And this has several aspects. I will just concentrate on what I call many-finger time and the frozen formalism problem. It will become clear what I'm talking about. And then there is another notion of time that clashes, another two notions of time that clash. It's the fact that the laws of physics are, to a very good accuracy at least, time reversal invariant, and yet there is a difference between past and future, which is evident to all of us, even tragically in our daily life. This is what I call the problem of the arrow of time. So let's start with the problems that you have when you put together a general relativity and quantum field theory. This is many-finger time. On top here, I have the notion of time that you, or the notion of simultaneity, really, that you have in quantum field theory. You work on Minkowski space, space of special relativity, which is a monolithic block in which you cannot really distinguish between time and space. Roughly, this direction is the time direction. And you can cut it with this mezzaluna knife, which is as large as the block itself, into flat slices, which are your hypersurfaces of simultaneity. And you can do it in an infinite, infinitely many different ways. But really, it's just essentially 10 parameters family of cuts. They are all related by the elements of the Lorentz group. You can all these notions of simultaneity corresponds to different the notions of simultaneity of different observers in Minkowski space, and so you can change the angle at which you cut this monolithic block. But that's all you can do. In general relativity, you have a very different situation. Space-time is, again, a block, but it's more wobbly. It's a manifold. It's not a rigid block like Minkowski space-time. And again, the time direction is roughly this, but you can cut the block any way you want. It's like a loaf of bread, which you can cut with a thin bread knife. So you can do this or this, as long as the angle of this, the blade of the knife doesn't go out of the light cone, you can do whatever, pretty much whatever you want. So you have a much larger freedom. So this is my intuitive explanation of the different notions of simultaneity that you have in GR and special relativity. Now, in quantum mechanics, the quantum mechanics really likes the Hamiltonian formalism. It's the framework in which it's best defined. So these people in the 60s and 70s, they pioneered work on quantum gravity by casting general relativity into Hamiltonian form. Now we'll try to give you an idea of what this means, because here you see the clash between quantum field theory and general relativity appear. So you have, if you want, an Hamiltonian description. You want a notion of time, so you choose a way to slice this loaf of bread, and you work on this foliation, this simultaneity, notion of simultaneity. So you have a direction which you call time, and you work on three-dimensional hypersurfaces, sigma t here. Then you define, you decompose the four-dimensional metric here into the projection on the three-dimensional surface, which is this three-dimensional metric here. And then the additional components that you have are belong to a vector, a three-dimensional vector, and a scalar. Well, they form the four-dimensional metric in this way. And this is what they mean. N is called the lapse, and it basically measures the distance at each point, the time separation at each point between the two successive hypersurfaces, two nearby hypersurfaces. The shift gives you a notion of what I call equilocality, because if you have a point which you attribute coordinates x and t on the first hypersurface, and you have here, it's not clearly visible, but you have a four vector which is orthogonal to the initial hypersurface, this projects this point to another point which could have different coordinates, x prime, on the second hypersurface, which has time t plus delta t. Now, xi is the infinitesimal vector that you need to reach the point at the new surface that has coordinates x, the same as before. So xi times delta t gives you this coordinates here. So it's a coordinate-dependent statement. It really defines it gives you the rate of change of the coordinate system. And the same holds for n, because it depends on, it can be changed by a diffeomorphism of the four-dimensional space-time that changes your parametrization of these surfaces locally. So if you do this, you can decompose the Einstein-Hilbert action with these variables n, xi, and g. And it turns out to depend on this quantity, which is called the extrinsic curvature, which really, basically, it's the time derivative of the three-dimensional metric corrected by this thing that takes into account the change in your coordinate system, essentially. It's a corrected derivative. So what happens here is that the Einstein-Hilbert action turns out to depend only on the time derivatives of G, of the spatial metric. So no time derivatives of n and xi appear. Therefore, these things are Lagrange multipliers. They are associated to constraints. They are not non-physical degrees of freedom. They are manifestations of a redundancy in your description of the system. So for example, if you now calculate the canonical momenta conjugate to the metric, you get this thing here. And you can rewrite the Einstein-Hilbert action in this way, and it turns out, so depending only on the metric momenta and the metric, and it turns out to be linear in the two Lagrange multipliers. So varying the action with respect to them gives you constraints, because these are their Euler-Lagrange equations, having no time derivatives. This is called Hamiltonian constraint, and this is called diffeomorphism constraint. So the action is a pure constraint action. It vanishes when the constraints are satisfied. What is the interpretation of these things? Constraints are associated to redundancies of your description, so what some people call symmetries. And this is particularly obvious for the red constraint, which is called diffeomorphism constraint, because it generates point transformations. So if you take the Poisson bracket of this thing with a metric, it gives you another, a transformed metric. So it has a geometrical interpretation. This is what you get. There is a Lie derivative here this expresses the change of a three-dimensional metric under a diffeomorphism, a three-dimensional coordinate transformation like this. These are my coordinates, curvilinear coordinates, and I mess them up infinitesimally with this vector field here, and this is, I get a different metric. So it has a pretty clear geometrical interpretation, and it's the kind, being linear in the momentum is the kind of constraint that we understand more or less at the quantum level. If we wanted to quantize this expression here, the vanishing of this, I would get just this statement, that the wave function of the universe, which is a wave function defined on the space of metrics, depends only on the intrinsic geometry of G, not on the coordinate system. It's invariant under diffeomorphisms. Now, the same story doesn't hold for the Hamiltonian constraint, the blue one. In fact, this thing is quadratic in the momenta, and it mixes up the metric and the momenta, the coordinates and the conjugate momenta. So it doesn't have any interpretation as a point transformation. It doesn't take you take a metric and give you a transform metric. In fact, what it does is actually to generate the evolution in a particular way. If I have an hypersurface here and I study the equations of motion generated by the equations of motion of this theory, I will get that the result after an infinitesimal step would be to give me the metric at a particular hypersurface following the first one, which is determined by the lapse. If I change the lapse and I do the same step, I will evolve more here and less here, depending on the value of the lapse locally. So this kind of transformation is really contains information about the dynamics and doesn't have an interpretation as a symmetry or a redundancy. In fact, the quantum version of that constraint, what I obtain if I apply the canonical quantization rules, I substitute every momenta by h bar and the derivative with respect to the metric conjugate to the momentum, is this. This is called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, and it has a lot of problems. You can see that at least it needs some ordering prescription here, but people don't know how to solve it or even how to make sense of it. Now, there is also a related problem to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, namely the problem of observables. Dirac, who led the foundations of the theory of Hamiltonian constraint systems, stated that if you want the observables of a theory with constraints, you have to take all the functions on your phase space that are that Poisson commute with the constraints. So basically, all the objects that are gauge invariant. Now, if you do that in this theory, and you take the objects that are invariant under that Poisson commute with this, you obtain constants of motion, because that thing generates evolution. So your observables in quantum gravity supposedly are time independent. They are what Karel Kukash called perennials, things that don't evolve. And this clashes a bit with our intuition about what we can actually observe of the universe. It doesn't look like they are, everything is frozen. And this is also related to the next problem I'll talk about. Kukash, by the way, proposed as a way out of this that observables should only commute with linear constraints, a different definition of observables. Now, you have only the diffeomorphism constraint, so your observables would be only diffeo-invariant. But there is a problem with this because there are too many degrees of freedom in diffeo-invariant quantities. There are three per point out of the metric, which has six degrees of freedom. You can extract 3 degrees of freedom if you mod out by diffeomorphisms. And our intuition tells us that the gravitational waves should have two polarizations, that basically the gravitational field should have 2 degrees of freedom. So probably these things contain redundant or gauge information and you're ignoring it. So now we come to the second aspect of the problem of time in quantum gravity. It's the frozen, so-called frozen formalism problem. Now, even if you remove the many finger time problem and fix effoliation, you arbitrarily decide that you're going to cut your loaf of bread in some way with some rule. So at every point here, every point uniquely belongs to a particular hypersurface of simultaneity, then you still have a problem, namely that the theory is reparametrization invariant. Let me explain. You can assign a different label to each slice here that you, these slices are a finite thickness proxy for an hypersurface of simultaneity. With these toothpicks and these flags, I assign a number to each slice so that with the only requirement that these numbers increase, that they are monotonically increasing. This is completely arbitrary. I can assign another number to each slice with these blue flags. And then as long as this grow as well, I have a map between the red and the blue flags, which is this one. And the theory doesn't care about which parametrization you choose, as long as this transformation between one and the other is monotonic. So you don't go back in time, actually. This is the simplest explanation I could produce of the idea of reparametrization invariance. Now, reparametrization invariant theories have vanishing Hamiltonian. If you, I can prove it simply here. If you have an action which is reparametrization invariant, it means that the Lagrangian is homogeneous of degree one in the velocities. Therefore, if I rescale all the velocities by alpha, that spits me out a factor of alpha here. So the action would be invariant under this thing. This, by Euler's homogeneous function theorem, implies that this equality, the sum of the velocities times dl by dq dot is equal to the Lagrangian itself. But now, if I calculate the momenta, the canonical momenta, and the Hamiltonian by the Legendre transform, you see that this expression is identical to this, which is L, and it cancels with the minus L. So the Hamiltonian is vanishing. This is a general characteristic of reparametrization invariant theories. The fact that the Hamiltonian vanishes is really what Dirac called the primary constraint. So it's a consequence of the, an algebraic consequence of the form of the momenta, the way they depend on Q and Q dot. And the quantization of such a theory doesn't give a time-dependent Schrödinger equation. It gives a time-independent one, such as this. It's just saying that this the wave function is in the kernel of this Hamiltonian operator here. So the solution is a frozen wave function, which has no time dependence. And the same happens with the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Just the difference is just that the Hamiltonian constraint, there's one Hamiltonian constraint per point. It's not a global thing. So what is the what I'm trying to say here is that we can make sense of this, of reparametrization invariant theories at the classical level. But at the quantum level, it's more tricky. And there's a lot of work on making sense of this. So at the classical level, what a reparametrization invariant model is telling you is that you have to, it's not that you don't have time. You have to abstract it from change, from physical things happening in the universe. So it respects what Mach called temporal relationalism. This is his opinion on Newton's absolute time. He said it's beyond our power to measure the changes of things by time. Quite the contrary, time is an abstraction at which we arrive by means of the change of things. So this realizes this idea. You have a configuration space, this potato, whatever, and you have an unparametrized curve on it, which is obtained by means of some variational principle that gives you, that doesn't care about the parametrization. And you have a sequence of states on this curve. You can, these states will be instantaneous configurations of the universe, for example. if this is a theory of the whole universe. Configurations will have properties. Like in this example, you have a car on a road that sits beside a bush and an airplane in the middle of two clouds. And in a following snapshot, instantaneous snapshot of the universe, the car is close to this road sign and the airplane is inside the clouds. So a physical statement that you can make here is that the car, in the time the car car took to go from the bush to the road sign, the airplane went from here to here. This only refers to changes that happen in the universe, physical clocks. And therefore, in a classical theory, you don't need to have a parametrization for your curve to make sense of the change of things and to have a notion of time. Now, the problem is that in the quantum theory, you don't have a curve. You have a wave function that is spread all over the potato. And if it comes out of this equation, it's just there. It doesn't evolve. And it's hard to make these sort of statements. But there's a huge amount of work put in trying to find out a quantum analog of this. OK, this was time in quantum gravity. Now let's switch to the last. So I'm just giving you an overview of the problems. And I don't want to, you have to make up your mind about a possible solution to these problems. This is a nice picture from minute physics. I think it conveys the idea of the arrow of time. The time has an arrow. When you're old, you remember when you were young. And when you were young, you remember when you were a child. In the future, there are records of the past, but not the opposite. So time has an arrow, and there's a difference between past and future. This is pretty obvious to everyone. But the laws of physics are time reversal symmetric, as I said. So how do you reconcile these two things? Well, the traditional answer to this question starts from thermodynamical considerations. The fact that it assumes that the universe is out of equilibrium, and therefore a system out of equilibrium distinguishes between past and future, while a system at equilibrium doesn't. So this is what it's based on. It's the thermodynamical arrow of time. To explain it, I use this pot metaphor. It's just the fact that we often see pots turning into cracked pots, but very seldom crack pots turning into pots. And what's the explanation for this? Is that second law of thermodynamics and the fact that pots have a lower entropy than cracked pots. So there are very few ways of being a proper pot, but many ways to be a cracked pot. And you know it very well. So out of this, Boltzmann built up a whole cosmogony, I suppose. He solved the time reversal symmetry puzzle with an ontology, with a framework that was popular at this time. So the universe was really considered not different than a gas in a box. So given the thermodynamical arrow time and this remarkable result by Poincaré, the Poincaré recurrence, you can prove that a system which is a thermodynamical equilibrium, if you leave it there forever, basically, and you wait long enough, it will have statistical fluctuations that will bring it out of equilibrium. So around one of these fluctuations, you will have a peak, a lower peak of minimal entropy. And then the system will relax back to thermodynamical equilibrium. The laws, the fundamental laws, do not distinguish between this side and this side. They are time reversal invariant. So they do not distinguish between the process, the fluctuations that brought you out of equilibrium and the relaxation process. And for this reason, Boltzmann put two arrows of time here. It's what I call a one past to future scenario. Here, there's just heat death. Not much is happening. Nothing can happen, actually. Everything is very well. The energy, there are no energy concentrations out of which you can build things. But here, worlds, universes can arise, and people, and And these people would regard the entropy peak, the lowest value of the entropy, as their line to their past, and the heat death line as line to their future. And there will be people here and here, and both will have different opinions on which is the arrow of time. And this also leads to a quite gloom picture of eons in which the universe just stays there in what Boltzmann called heat death, and nothing happens. While you have very rare fluctuations which are separated by these immense distances. So it's an eternal recurrence of this scenario of one past, two futures. But then in our universe, after all we learned from observations and from modern cosmology, it doesn't look like a gas in a box, really. So there are several problems with Boltzmann's proposal. I would say it doesn't really look like our universe came out of a fluctuation, a spontaneous fluctuation in a heat in a system of a system which was at equilibrium. Here, also, if you just look at the entropy of matter, galaxies, stars, visible matter, it doesn't look like it's increasing. It's quite the contrary, actually, because here it was more like a plasma swoop, and here it's very clamped, and there are stars and things. So, of course, one idea is to attribute all the entropy growth to the gravitational degrees of freedom. But then the definition of a gravitational entropy is a very open problem. Perros wrote a lot about this, and there's no conclusion. I'm going to give you a thought-provoking observation that might lead to a very different take on this problem very soon. But so let's move to the second part of our talk. Are there questions about the first part? So as I told you, I don't want to feed you with answers. This is just my only slide on about the answers that the theory I'm studying now could provide for all those our problems with the definition of time that I showed you. Explaining them would require too many technical details, so I'll just skip that, and I will concentrate on this arrow of time proposal that I've been working on recently. But just for completeness, just to give you an idea of what I'm doing, we are studying this theory, shape dynamics, which describes the universe as a sequence of shapes. This technically means that there are three-dimensional geometries, modulo scale, so modulo local conformal transformations. So it's really just the angle determining part of the metric and not the length determining one. That is gauge for this theory. And essentially, the theory solves the many finger time problem and the other ones that I mentioned are not present in this theory because the theory is equivalent to general relativity only in a particular class of spacetimes, the ones that admit a constant mean curvature foliation. So this constant mean curvature foliation means that you have the mean curvature, the extrinsic curvature measures the expansion of space, of local volumes at each point, how much they inflate. And in this foliation, this is, for example, a local three-dimensional volume. In this foliation, this thing expands at the same rate everywhere. So it's a unique notion of simultaneity that is there, and it's the one in which the theory is equivalent to GR. Then, having this, it trivially solved the many-finger time problem, because you don't have that arbitrariness in the choice of foliation. And also, you don't have an Hamiltonian constraint as in GR. Even before facing the problem of quantization, there's the Hamiltonian constraint must really be interpreted as a particular gauge fixing, so a particular coordinate choice or choice of scale that gives you the equivalence with GR. Therefore, you don't really quantize it. There's no Wheeler-DeWitt equation in this theory. And then the observables are 2 degrees of freedom per point, and they have a simple geometrical interpretation. They are conformal invariant and diff invariant. And there is no frozen formalism problem if one uses this value of the mean extrinsic curvature, which is constant everywhere as your unique label of time. Okay, let's put this aside and let's move to the hour of time things. So I've been doing this, as I said, with Julian Barbour and Tim Kozlowski recently. It's all very open, and it's really a more of a thought-provoking idea. The question is this. Is there really a contradiction between fundamentally time reversal invariant laws and a narrow time? Because what we did is to find an example of a system in which the laws are time reversal invariant, but there is clearly a narrow time, and it's not of thermodynamical origin. There are no statistical considerations. There's no ensemble. It's every solution of the theory has this narrow time. And it's of the Boltzmann type with two futures and one past. So, and the kind of theories that do this is precisely the class of theories to which general relativity belongs. And, but I will discuss it in the simpler example of Newtonian gravity. So what people call the n-body problem. N-point particles interacting with a Newtonian potential, Newton's law. And to make this a good model for a general relativity, in the sense that it has the same architectonic structures, we will assume these constraints. There are the total angular momentum of the system, the total linear momentum, but this is really trivial for Galilean invariants, must vanish. These are linear constraints in the momenta, which are really analog to the diffeomorphism constraint of general relativity. They imply that there are no extraneous frames in the theory. So an angular momentum will point somewhere and will give you a preferred direction, and you don't want this. You want the universe to be self-contained. The other important assumption is that the total energy of the theory, which would anyway be a conserved quantity, is zero. If it's not zero, that will give you this conserved quantity which sets a scale. That would prevent it to be a good model for essentially general relativity in the shape dynamics formulation. Okay, so this is the statement. The all solutions, or the generic solution of this theory, apart from a set of measure zero, behaves like this. There is a central region where the system is has minimal size, it's all concentrated, and it has a maximal homogeneity. Here, no particle is closer, is particularly close to any other particle. They are more or less homogeneous. Then, away from that, in the two directions of Newtonian time, the system explodes, basically. It expands, and it breaks up into clusters and then some systems and keeps breaking up until basically it's essentially composed only of pairs, so bound pairs of particles, which are called Kepler pairs because they asymptotically they perform Keplerian orbits, and isolated particles. And these things are getting more and more isolated, and they fly apart. This part and this part in the two opposite directions, they look like an expanding universe, essentially. And the other thing is that we found a better way to express this arrow, this fact that the system has this sort of irreversibility in the solution, through a measure of what we call complexity. So this is a function that is monotonic. It's not monotonic, but it's growing secularly on the two branches of the solution, of every solution. We called it complexity, but it should have probably, it could be even called clustering more than complexity. It measures how clumpy the system is. It's made of the two simplest lengths democratic length that I can build in the system with my relative distances between the particles. So this is the mean harmonic length. So it's a mass-weighted average of the inverse of the distance between any pair of particles. You average it over all particles. And it turns out to be proportional through a time-independent constant, which is the total mass squared, to minus the Newton potential. Well, the inverse of this is a length. And it's dominated by the shortest, the smallest distance between any two particles. That's the one that gives you most of its value. The rest, when two particles are distant, they don't contribute much to this. Then you have this other quantity, which I call the root mean square length. This measures the size of the whole system. It's again, mass weighted. This should be squared, sorry, there's a square here. Square distance between any pair of particles, averaged over all particles. The square root of this is the root mean square length. And it's proportional through the total mass to the center of mass moment of inertia of the system, which is an important quantity. So it measures, basically it's dominated by the largest distance between any two particles. And it measures the size of the whole system democratically, assigning a just weight to any particle or pair of particles. So the complexity function or clustering function is this thing, the ratio between these two lengths. It measures how big is the system in units of the smallest distance between any two particles. So if the system is very homogeneous, this is very low. If any two particles fall on top of each other and one of these things goes close to zero, this thing blows up and it's unbounded from above. Now, the behavior of this quantity is this on this sort of solution. This is for 1,000 particles. It wobbles because the system creates these subsystems like Kepler pairs. They orbit around each other and they give some periodic contributions which sum and average out with each other. So the more particles you add, the more smooth this curve is. Now, the explanation of this property is the following. It takes a bit, but it's nice. And people don't really know about the n-body problem and this sort of physics in undergrad or graduate classes. So the first property that the system has is known as dynamical similarity. So if a potential is homogeneous of degree k, which means that if I rescale all the distance or the particle positions by alpha, the potential is rescaled by alpha to the k, then I have this symmetry. Rescaling all the distances gives me another solution of the theory in which the time, the Newtonian time, is rescaled by this factor. If k is minus 1, like in Newton's potential, this gives me essentially the Kepler's third law, which relates the semi-major axis of an orbit, a planetary orbit with its period, with its orbital period. From this and from Newton's laws, derives this property called Lagrange-Jacobi relation. And if I take the time derivative of the center of mass moment of inertia, that is 2d. D is this quantity, which I call the dilatational momentum. It measures the rate of expansion or contraction of the whole system. It's a scalar product between R and P, right? Now, if I take the second derivative of this quantity and the potential is homogeneous of degree K, I obtain this thing here, where E is the energy, so it's the value of the Hamiltonian, essentially, on that solution. Now, if the system has Newton's potential, K is minus 1, and this is what I get. The second derivative is positive, non-zero, but positive, strictly positive, if the energy is positive or zero. So D is a monotonic quantity, what people in n-body physics called a Lyapunov function. And therefore, it can be used as a time variable, as a sort of internal clock for the system. And this is kind of illuminating for what regard this property here, this behavior. So keep this D in mind. If you use D as internal time, then you have its conjugate variable, which measures the size of the system, essentially. It's conjugate because, you know, the time derivative of the moment of inertia is D. So and the conjugate variable to something that you use as an internal time behaves, plays the role of an Hamiltonian. It generates time translation, essentially. So if you remove these quantities from the game because you interpret one as time and the other as Hamiltonian, what you're left is just the scale degrees of freedom, the shape degrees of freedom. So the relative configuration of the system modulo its size. To understand what a shape is in this particular context, it's nice to see the example of n equals 3, the three-body problem. The system, the relative configurations of the system are triangles, so three-point particles. And a triangle is defined by the two internal angles and its scale size. So essentially, you could use its area, for example, or one of the sides. So there is one scale and one shape degree of freedom. The shape degrees of freedom are the two internal angles. So the configuration space of this system, when you mod out the scale, is two-dimensional. I call it shape space. And in the particular case of in n equals 3, it's two-dimensional. And there is a nice representation of this space on a sphere. The sphere is like that. You have the equilateral triangle on the two poles. And on the equator, you have collinear configurations in which the three particles are on a line and the triangle is degenerate. Then I plotted on this sphere the complexity function, or clustering function, as an elevation plot. Here it has a minimum at the equilateral triangle because it's the least complex shape somehow. And then it has an infinite value here where two of the three particles collide. These are the two body collisions. And there are three of them according to which pair collides. Then there are other three important shapes. It's the Euler configurations. These are important because the complexity function here has a saddle point. So if you move towards that direction, it decreases. And towards this direction, it increases. Now, this is the generic solution for the three-body problem with zero energy and zero angular momentum. It looks like this. In the infinite past, you have a Kepler pair, a pair of particles orbiting each other. And it meets the third particle coming from infinitely far here. Here, a complicated three-body interaction takes place. And then the system spits out another Kepler pair and another isolated particle. This Kepler pair might be the same as before, or as in this case, there might be a pair exchange, the blue for the red particle. And again, the complexity function on this solution wobbles when this thing orbit each other, but it has a minimum at the center and it grows monotonical in the two time directions. Now on shape space, this same solution looks like this. It splits into two branches, which they are different here. When the expansion D, the dilatational momentum is zero. So when the system stops contracting and starts expanding again. And I plotted the two solutions, one in yellow and the other in red. And what they do is they just fold down this towards the two-body collision. Because you see why. If you go towards the future here, this distance here becomes smaller and smaller with respect to the distance to the other isolated particle. Now, The explanation of this is very simple if you use d as your internal time. Because in that case, the system behaves like a point particle in this shape space, which moves according to the force generated by a potential, which is minus the complexity. So it's something that has a singularity at the two-body collision, and it's infinitely negative. And here it has a maximum, and here a saddle point. And in addition to that, the system has a time-dependent Hamiltonian, which can be reformulated as a system with a time-independent Hamiltonian by the linear friction. So, and this is the easiest way to understand this. You have a potential dragging this point particle towards the two-body collision, and then a linear friction which depletes its kinetic energy in shape space, its shape kinetic energy. Therefore, the particle cannot just keep orbiting around the two-body collision. It will lose kinetic energy and spiral down the potential well. And with this result, you can prove that C, on average, will grow monotonically, because this thing will go down and down and reach the collision only asymptotically in the infinite future, or past in this case. Moreover, there is a nice observation here, because these solutions like this are not also all solutions to the zero energy three-body problem. There's a smaller set of solutions. It's a measure zero set, which do not have two branches. They end up at a collision. When the system falls down towards the center, the three particles happen to touch each other exactly at the same time. The moment of inertia goes to zero, and there's a sort of singularity there. It cannot be continued. Now, something that when I read about it in the embodied literature, I found a bit counterintuitive is the fact that the system cannot reach this central collision in any shape. The final shape at the moment of collision can be only one of these four in the three-body case. Either the equilateral triangle or one of the three Euler configurations. And this is readily understood in the picture, in the description in shape space, because these are the maxima and the saddle points of the complexity function. So they are stationary points of the potential of the system. So it's where the system has no shape force. There's no force compelling the point, the representative point, to move in shape space. And this is where the system ends up there, and you cannot continue past that point. Moreover, you also understand why it's a measure zero set, because you really have to fine tune your curve, your solution, to really hit precisely that point and reach that point with zero speed, because otherwise you would overshoot. And all of this holds also for the generically for the n-body problem. You have that there are no minima of this complexity function, therefore, and there's a lot of Euler-like configurations or maxima, even for generic n. So this is a nice explanation. So nothing. This is just the observation that we have this sort of irreversibility in a very familiar system, the n-body problem. And in the shape dynamics description of general relativity, things are pretty much like that. If you use your expansion rate as time, you find a system that has a sort of, that can be described on shape space as a system with a linear friction. I want to give you also a further observation in relation to this. This is Einstein, who, in his autobiographical notes in 1949, he confessed committing a sin while formulating his theory of relativity. He said that you have two different, ontologically different things in the theory, measuring rods and clocks and the rest, anything else, so physical things like electromagnetic field or matter and whatever. And he said, this is not very consistent. The theory, by giving ontological preference to the metric or the four-dimensional metric as the primary object in the theory, it really assumes that there are, it's like an axiom for the theory. There are objects that you call rods and clocks, with which you can measure intervals of proper time or the size of things. This also has stricken Weil, actually. Weil, he said that he wasn't satisfied with the fact that in Riemannian geometry you can parallel transport vectors and their direction is not preserved by parallel transport, but their size is. So it makes sense to talk about the absolute size of a thing in Riemannian geometry. So Einstein would have been more satisfied by a theory in which rods and clocks would have to be represented as solutions to the basic equations. So things that are stable, that possess the properties of rods and clocks, namely of being mutually congruent and being useful to keep time, to keep appointments, for example, but they emerge from the solutions of the theory. They're not assumed to be there from the start. And this is, again, just an observation, but I think that this is precisely what's happening, for example, in the n-body problem. Okay, this is the two-dimensional shape space, and this is a configuration for the n-body problem, but you understand what I mean here. If you take a solution to one of the generic solutions to the n-body problem, when it's far down the potential well, so the complexity function is very high, this system is in a very structured state and very clumpy one. You have formed a lot of Kepler pairs and isolated particles. And these things are rods and clocks that are generated dynamically. They are not to be found here when the system is in a low complexity state, because there is just chaos. Here, you have these Kepler pairs which are drifting apart, and they are exchanging less and less energy, angular momentum, and linear momentum with the other subsystems. So their orbital period is becoming more and more conserved. And their semi-major axis also is becoming more and more stable. So if you compare the length of this thing, the size of this Kepler pair with another, asymptotically they will become constant. They will keep mutual congruence just by virtue of the dynamical law. And the same thing happens for their periods. If this ticks three times every tick of this one, that will be true in the future more and more, because they will become more and more isolated. So nothing like that can be found here, because you don't have the formation of stable subsystems and they're not getting isolated. These two things have the good properties that you would ask from a rod and a clock in a theory with absolute simultaneity, like Newtonian gravity. For example, if I drew a random curve with a marker on shape space that spirals down the potential well without following any particular law, I will get something like this, the formation of Kepler pairs and everything. But these pairs will have a time-dependent size that will never stabilize. They won't be mutually congruent at any time. They will grow with respect to each other and shrink. And their periods will be random. They will not be asymptotically constant in ratio. Therefore, there is something deep with the dynamical law that we used here to describe this system that fosters the generation of rods and clocks. And eventually, in the shape dynamic version of this, when we're talking about general relativity, this is what allows the emergence of space-time out of a theory which only uses conformal geometries, so scale-free geometries, a succession of three-dimensional scale-free geometries. You can stack them up and form a four-dimensional space-time, which makes sense precisely because of this property. So nothing, this is a striking observation for me. So, well, this is just to summarize the last part of the talk. I wanted to give you this hint that there could be an explanation for the arrow of time we all observe in the universe, which is just an effect of the dynamical law, and that's nothing to do with a special initial condition or entropy fluctuations, and it has nothing to do with entropy at all, actually. And maybe complexity or clustering is the is a good way to define your arrow time as the direction in which the universe gets more structured and more complex. And it's striking that this is established at this point for the n-body problem. It's striking that the simplest dimensionless measure of complexity is what really drives the dynamics. So the identification between the arrow of time and complexity growth is kind of obvious in that case. And there is this further observation that growth of complexity is what allows the emergence of rods and clocks, and therefore, ultimately, space-time as a meaningful concept for doing physics. I would have other observations regarding information and in relation to this, but I kept them out of the talk because actually I finished my time, so this is probably it's best to close it here. Thank you.
What the shape theorem does is assigns probabilities to paths through shape space.
Yes.
What are these probabilities for?
Wait, probabilities to what? Not
to
paths.
To
shapes.
Different configurations.
Yeah.
So what are the probabilities for?
That's a good question. No idea because so this is this is shape space. If you quantize the theory, you would have a wave function of a shape space, and it evolves because it has a physical Hamiltonian, it's not a constraint. And you have probabilities for different shapes of the universe. Now, if this wave function is spread over macroscopically different shapes, and it starts to make sense of it from a realistic perspective, because we don't see superpositions of wildly different space universes. Therefore, my answer is I don't know. And that is one of the biggest conceptual problems with quantum gravity in general, I would say. There must be some... the conceptual status of this thing, like a wave function of the universe, is very shaky at this point. So I'm not quite satisfied with this answer, but I suppose I don't have anything.
Want to follow up?
No.
Another question from the student? Come on, Dad. This is a puzzle phase. Do you want to express your puzzle? Okay, then we open it up. Bianca?
So just to clarify, so D is monotonic always?
It's monotonic, yes.
But so you could also take it as, I mean, you actually use it as a time.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition, you have you could use the complexity measure as a time.
That's not monotonic.
But,
that is monotonic on average.
But so you say that is kind of an effective time. Well, it gives you the arrow of time.
Yeah, that's, but, you know, in Boltzmann's time, nobody would have actually used the precise value of the entropy as your clock, really, as your time, as your notion of duration, because that can fluctuate. So you have two things, something that is truly monotonic, like Newton's absolute time, and something that is monotonic on average that points towards the future. It tells you which direction.
But
the
so then
is.
We have this here also D, which is really absolutely monotonic.
Yes, that is strictly monotonic.
And
by
so is there some proposal for such a function in Dirac?
Yeah, it's when space-time is CMC foliable, which is a large class of space-times, then it's York time. So it's the analog thing. It's really the product of the momentum times the metric average over all space. So it measures the expansion everywhere. And you can show that in a slab of space-time, that thing will be monotonic, strictly monotonic.
Repeat the question. It's impossible to hear back there.
What?
Repeat the question.
Okay.
Repeat the question.
What is the monotonic quantity in GR? You say York time.
York time. Yes.
And I say, what happens in the time symmetric?
It vanishes at the time symmetric point.
So there you have the minimum.
Yes.
So it's not really monotonic.
No, it's not the minimum of the York time. It's well, the square of the York time would have by zero, but it's negative before and positive after.
Okay.
Like in the sitter, it contracts and expands.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is this similar to the Boltzmann fluctuation picture in that, more ordered configurations are less likely?
What is the question? Again, more order configurations.
It's similar to Boltzmann in that more order configurations
are the least likely.
What is the answer?
Well, no, you have to make it more precise because they are least likely in which sense?
Well,
according to which measure?
Lower probabilities to the configuration, to the shapes of the universe which are more ordered.
The thing is, at what time? That's the question. So, for any solution, you would see that it will pass through a very low complexity configuration, necessarily one of these blue regions. Therefore, there is a time at which these are very probable, and at late time they are very unlikely. This is the picture, I think.
Well, now that's a bit of the first I don't
think. Hi. You said that shape dynamics is equivalent to general relativity in some special cases. My question is, do you have any sort of equivalence principle? And related to that, do you only have a global definition of time, or is there any local meaning for time for local observables or something like that, observers?
Formulating an equivalence principle in shape dynamics, really from first principles, in shape dynamics terms would be tricky. It's not a natural language in which you would do it. Of course, you can always make reference to the equivalence with GR. So in at least large regions and in situations, in particularly nice situations, actually most that are experimentally tested, the theories are equivalent. You can map the solutions from one to the other. And then through the analog statement in GR, whenever this can be physically formulated, like, you know, equivalence of the inertial and gravitational mass or the universality of free fall, these sort of things, then you can, you can make reference to GR. But formulating it intrinsically in shape dynamics would be surely tricky. Now, it's interesting to ask the question, is it broken?
Yes,
I don't know, because there are situations in which the two theories don't agree, in which you cannot really reconstruct a single space-time or a globally hyperbolic space-time out of a shape dynamics solution. There are global obstructions to doing that. And what about the equivalence principle in those cases? That is an open question.
So in this problem, time is sort of like a global concept. It has no local meaning.
Yes. So for local notions of time, well, all the everything that we learned from GR, it doesn't go doesn't go away. It's still there. So again, in any situation in which you have a weakly backreacting subsystem, like a test clock or a test something, they will tick a proper time, which is just the same general relativity, and you see that the effect is really the same as this. Being weakly backreacting and isolated is like in Newtonian gravity being isolated here. You're not perturbed by you're not too heavy, you're not perturbed by, you, by your own influence, and you're, and therefore you take a good time. So this is something that we should have in general in shape dynamics, the theoretical version.
Okay,
Professor
Ron.
So in GR, what would be a complexity function?
I don't know, but if you take a homogeneous model like Bianchi 9, at least with the simplest, with Van der Sphere, with the simplest topology, the role of the potential is played by the what we call the Yamabe constant. So that thing is a spatial average of the curvature of the Ricci scalar, but I have no theorem, but I don't claim genericity of this, I don't know, that's an indication. So I don't have an equivalent of complexity for GR. That's a candidate, because it's defined in any space-time, or solution, sorry. But I don't know if that has the same properties of this. So it's something that we need to explore.
So it's not clear that this picture, you know, translate to a GR picture.
Yeah, the thing that translates is, well, the monotonicity of that dilatational object, and the fact that you can rewrite everything in shape space, and then you have this sort of linear friction thing that here allows the complexity to grow. In GR, I don't have a definition of complexity in general. So, but in that homogeneous model, I do, but I don't know if it translates completely into GR, yes.
Okay, Rafael and Sammy for last. Matteo and then Ted and then.
Okay, so the main observation you made is the complexity of the system goes down, generically goes down and then up. Mm-hmm. I wonder, I'm curious, what's the basis for the statement? The gravitational unbody problem is definitely not an integrable system. So what did you do? Did you run 1,000 simulations and you observed that most of the time it was like that? What's the basis for the statement?
Can you repeat the question again?
Yes, what's the basis of the statement for, well, to say that the complexity function does, where is it? That's this. Because the n-body problem, you don't have the generic solution. It's not an integrable system. You cannot solve it exactly. You cannot prove analytically that the system would behave like that. We use the some results by Marcial and Sari on the n-body problem, and they prove some much weaker statements, but they allow you to they allow them to prove that the system will break up in subsystems and clusters. I think they call it like that. And one of those will, the larger ones will separate like t to the, like linearly with time, and the other ones will expand at most like t to the 2/3, and you have bounds on that. So you have the, essentially it's the asymptotics of the n-body problem that helps you. If you have these results, you can put bounds on the ICM, and you can you have other results about the lower bounds for the closest pairs, and therefore you can prove that the complexity will grow. Of course, this statement holds for the generic solution. If you have
so, what's the generic solution? I have no idea.
Well, this is what they it's the bulk of the solutions. The others are all measure zero according to some.
Yes,
that's important.
Yeah, yeah,
that's sure. Important.
But it's easy for me to imagine 10 particles. I send them off in radial directions.
Yeah.
They go away. This is a solution that will not display this field.
Well, you have to fit the energy.
Follow that one back.
Yes.
That is a solution that we kindly described. Follow that one back with the time. Goes through central clumping and then disperses it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Forward in time, they will. If the energy is zero, you pick it at random, you will see the complexity growing. But again, there are exceptions. For example, there's a solution that they found for the five-body problem, which there is one particle that is exchanged between two Kepler pairs back and forth, and it eats energy out of the Kepler pair to accelerate more and more, and it's a super hyperbolic escape. So those bounds that we used in that case, they don't hold, and one should have a different treatment for that. But they are very fine-tuned solutions. So this is the thing.
I guess a classical and a quantum question. I'll ask the classical one now. What can you elaborate on to what extent shape dynamics is consistent with general relativity, you know, from a practical point of view? I mean, can we imagine that everything we've observed that's consistent with general relativity can be fit in a shape dynamics framework, and we just haven't yet encountered the difference between the two theories? Or is it already clear that somehow shape dynamics is inadequate to describe, you know, currently observed relativistic physics?
I'm not sure what is the precise angle you're taking, but let me try.
Perhaps black holes.
I mean, starting with initial data. I mean,
let me say what I think the answer is, and you correct me. For compact space-times, considering regions outside of horizons, where it's known the shape that space-times are CMC fully
outside. So, could you say that again?
For compact space-times outside of horizons. So any observation, assuming that the space-time is spatially compact,
okay,
and we've only made observations outside of horizons.
Yeah.
And those solutions, if I'm correct or wrong, are CMC foldable. And therefore, there is the equivalence of generic enough for our purpose.
Is that a correct statement?
Yeah, there's a tricky part, your definition of horizons, of course.
Well,
maybe there's a simpler answer that just technically shape dynamics is just a gauge GR with a gauge fixing.
Yeah, but the question is that gauge always accessible, mm-hmm. and is the accessibility preserved in time?
No, it isn't always.
By definition,
accessible.
You look at
it isn't. Not all solutions of GR would be CMC foldable, and in fact they find differences. Lee was mentioning horizons because.
But you're being too weak because we've never seen inside of a horizon.
Yeah.
We could be falling into a horizon. We don't know, right? So.
Maybe I'm looking at you, you know, from the inside of an horizon. So that's not an argument.
Okay. So be careful.
And we're on the same side.
Too weak, so the answer is I didn't check all possible solutions of GR that we have a complete understanding of, and we have a good experimental handle of that. Many cases, this is fine. Just look at the literature on numerical relativity. They use the CMC. For example, in the asymptotically flat case, if you try to reproduce the Schwarzschild solution, you're okay up to the horizon. Then inside the horizon, you have a totally different thing. You have an isotropic line element. So this is a difference. Asymptotically flat is not very nice, in particular if you're.
But does that mean that the flow on phase space is incomplete, and therefore that it's not clear what it means to quantize the theory? I have an initial configuration with no.
You continue the solution past the horizon, fine. It's just not the same solution as general relativity.
Okay, so there's a unique evolution
and
it deviates. But what horizon are we talking about here? It's not the global event horizon, right? Is it some. In a time dependent space time, what are you talking about?
In shape dynamics, you have it's where the CMC foliation will fail.
And do you know that always happens outside of a global event horizon?
No, I know it for asymptotically, in the asymptotically flat case, for a single solution. This is a single, actually a quite new result.
So it may fail in an observable region of space-time. Is that the statement?
Possibly.
Yeah, I don't have an answer to this point. Yeah. Possibly.
I mean, the boundary of space-time from the point of view of same shape dynamics are inside our, you know, the usual notion of space-time. So, you know, this variation doesn't cover the whole space-time. So it's a gauge fixing.
That's not what I'm asking. I'm asking if it could be observed.
Well, it's a gauge fixing. So at some point, yeah, there's some particle that we, you know, from our point of view, cross this CMC slicing that's extended. The gauge fixing cannot be extended everywhere, like in any good theory. So it would be, you know, from the point of view of GR. If you follow particles through space-time, at some point it will go through a case where there exists no CMC.
Yeah,
so the end of time in shape dynamics is not the end of time.
The proper time of the particle,
yeah.
Yes.
The CMC time will go to infinity where the proper time of a particle will be finite. That would be the type of problem.
Yeah, this is why if all these asymptotically flat things are to be trusted, you have to describe a wormhole or whatever it is, a black hole in a different way in shape dynamics. I think you get, I don't think you can have. We have to check what happens to the proper time of a particle falling through that horizon. But I think you should cross it in a finite in proper time. Observers outside will never watch it cross it because the CMC foliation will go to infinite in the infinite
well,
future.
Well, maybe, but you said that's not an established result. I mean, maybe
maybe
an observer outside of a global event horizon could see that, depending on the configuration.
Yeah, no, in the asymptotically flat, short, spherically symmetric one, they won't.
But that's a very special case.
Yes, exactly. So that's not an established result.
Okay.
What do you mean by CMC for asymptotically flat? It's asymptotically hyperbolic.
That's not.
So
it's maximal.
It's not
CMC.
Actually a quotient surface.
It's maximal, not CMC.
Oh, but then it can't be used as a time. It's just zero. It just remains zero.
What? Sorry?
Isn't it? A maximal slicing has zero Yorick time.
Yes.
So it doesn't function as time.
That's why the asymptotically flat is probably a description of a local region in which you assume that there's matter at infinity or stuff like that. But it makes some sense to take maximal slicing and the shape dynamics description for this sort of situation. CMC doesn't really, because it really makes sense only when the space is compact. So I really interpret the asymptotically flat results as take a CMC compact universe, take a small region which is separated by all the matter, and you work it for a while, and you don't notice the change in your time much. It's like flat for you. So the expansion is not measurable for you, and that's what it's meant for. But maybe you can describe, you know, local horizons and sometimes. I don't trust these results 100%. I would like to do it in a compact case.
Can I ask the quantum side now?
Ralph has been waiting a long time, so let's go to Ralph.
Well, I've waited so long, I saved up three questions. Let me ask one that I think will be short, and then one that may be a little longer. It's related to what we just were talking about. The short one, it sounds like you could, in this kind of framework, you could accommodate one bounce, one contraction and re-expansion, judging by the Newtonian analog, but not more. So in other words, would you say this rules out a kind of cyclic cosmology in which the universe is expanding and recontracting and then expanding again?
I wouldn't say that. At the classical level, yes. But what is the quantum mechanics of this? Maybe there's not even a bounce. Maybe also the two future scenario goes away. So, but again, I don't know what's the meaning of the wave function of the universe. So, but yes, at the classical level, surely that's one bounce that will exclude
I mean, you're just thinking that if you want the time to continue increasing, even if it has a quantum phase where it bounces and you don't understand, later on it'll be classical again, and then it seems like the time will become cyclic rather than monotonically increasing.
Yeah, I suppose so. That wouldn't be compatible with the cycle.
Presumably it's not compatible with. But as you say, you have to interpret the wave function.
Yeah.
It's not compatible with the idea of this being true time, which increases monotonically. So the second question was related to what we were just talking about. I mean, I think it's a very beautiful idea that entropy and time are somehow the same thing, because that would explain in some deep way the second law of thermodynamics. I actually believed this for at least a week once, maybe slightly longer, but I could never convince myself that it really worked. Now you're reviving, in a sense, reviving that idea. So let me.
I'm relying on that.
Reviving?
Yeah.
You're promoting that, aren't you? Suggesting that.
It's not statistics.
That's just not entropy. That's. But.
What?
It's this thing that I'm proposing is. Indicating the arrow time is not entropy.
I thought you were trying to make. I thought you were suggesting that it could serve as a replacement for entropy.
Yes.
Well, so that means
entropy
that
of course,
do for us
here,
whatever.
If you have a, when the universe is very structured, if you have a star, whatever, a subsystem, the usual statistical arguments will apply, and then you would have a growing entropy in that direction. So I'm not saying that the second law of thermodynamics doesn't hold or something. It holds for subsystems.
No, but are you saying we can put the second law of thermodynamics on a deeper foundation because of this relation? I thought you were suggesting that some sort of complexity measure.
Yes.
Both serves the role of time and measures entropy.
No, it measures complexity. I don't know if it measures entropy or. It's just a different concept. I would
not. Oh, okay. So this would not somehow explain the second law.
I've never thought that it could explain this.
Oh, sorry. I missed that. I thought that's what you were.
Yeah.
Finally, I want to make a
short. If you have any specific idea, that would be nice to.
I mean, I want to go back to the beginning of your talk.
Yeah.
Sure. Because
Yeah, you said something that didn't seem right to me, and it doesn't seem compatible with what you said later, which is that there's some difficulty in the formation of stars and so on, that seems to be at odds with the second law of thermodynamics, unless we introduce some idea of gravitational entropy, which is not understood.
No, I was trying to say that the Boltzmann cyclic scenario is... it doesn't really look compatible.
Oh, no.
Well,
again, maybe I misunderstood again. Didn't you, when you were talking about difficulties with the arrow of time and so on, didn't you talk about that the formation of stars?
Oh, stars, okay.
Stars in some way seems to be
inconsistent
with the second law. If you didn't say that, then.
No, I was saying that you need to attribute some entropy to the gravitational degrees of freedom.
That's what's not so clear to me. Because you can do, most people do when they do simulations of stellar formation and halos and galaxies and stuff. They basically just use Newtonian mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
And the entropy would, in that case, be all in the small scale motions of the particles that are contracting. And I'd never heard anyone worry that there was any violation of the second law. So it seems to me it's basically safe, even without worrying about how to attribute gravitational degrees of freedom, entropy to gravitational degrees of freedom. If you form black holes, then it will become very relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Can I make a suggestion that this is, my understanding is that this is a complex question, and we're not going to settle in 2 minutes, and we're all hungry. I'll enjoy the talk.
Ted?
So, do you want to? Ted? Okay, let's go back to Ted for one quick question about time.
Yeah, it is quick. The shape dynamics idea is beautiful, but in quantum gravity, there is a length scale, as I understand it. Planck length has to play a role. So I just wonder, what's the thought if you quantize the shape dynamics description, and that introduces a fundamental length, is that consistent with...
From my point of view, it's consistent with the principles of shape dynamics to the extent that it's dynamically determined, that it's not something external to the universe. That it's not like a scale, a God-given scale that is there and does not depend on anything else. A quantum scenario which resonates more with these principles for me is, for example, think about dimensional transmutation. Is that, yes, so you have a theory without fundamental, dimensionful constants, but then loop corrections give you an effective theory which has such a thing. Now, this is the value of that dimensionful quantity depends on the state of the universe. It's not there, it's not God-given. It's an effective description which relies on the particular state of matter and your fields. That is a sort of a scenario which I would consider compatible with shape dynamics. If it's really a lattice of some sort on which the universe has been run like a simulation, then shape dynamics might maybe be a tool, a description, but cannot be really fundamental, I suppose. So this is my take, and other authors will have different ideas.
Okay. But if I can just start before
you.
Okay. I just have a very simple question. So the time error you're talking about, it's a classical error. It's not a quantum, right? There's nothing about quantum time, right? There's no quantum fluctuation between past and future, right?
There's no quantum fluctuation
between the time error defined as past and future.
What do you mean with a quantum? I didn't quite understand it.
It's the demonstration of the time's error in the nearby problem is entirely fancy.
Yes.
Yes. The answer is yes.
Okay. Thanks.
That's the word of the answer.
Yes.
No, but there's a... So only space is conformal. So you have a time scale. So, might be some
example,
other...
Yeah.
That you get in
scale. Yeah, so...
Is it correct?
I don't know. It's an interesting thought, anyway, because, really, the Planck scale is a space-time concept, I would say, no? It's a space-time scale.
Yeah, but shape dynamics is only...
spatially conformant. Yes,
they
you know that.
They have a reparamization that it's a time also.
Yeah, but this is different from 4D conformal.
It is different.
Much
this
different.
Is
yes.
different from 4D conformal
yes.
itself.
Yeah.
So it's a different concept.
It's okay. Maybe you can...
When you write down the action, is it scale invariant or not? Was an appropriate scale? I guess that's the question.
I think it's...
You think it's not scale invariant?
But I don't know which... This action is...
No. It's like... like Newton's... like the Newtonian body problem, you wouldn't say it's scale invariant.
Then I would say it's not scale invariant.
It's not scale invariant, but yeah, the observation is that you can basically integrate away the degrees of freedom regarding scale and work only with the shape ones, and you don't lose, you lose nothing. So then there is a description which is scale invariant, but. In the sense that it's it only lives on shape space here.
But I think Bianca's point is at the level of the action itself, there's not a scale invariant, so that means there is a dimensional constant in the action, and that could be the basis of the Planck length. Sure, that could be how the Planck length gets in.
Yeah.
Is that right? But
her observation was really regarding spatial conformal symmetry, that the scale invariance is only a spatial thing,
right,
and there's
no.
So maybe we can put this Planck scale well, attributed to, I don't know, time in some sense?
Clock time.
Yeah.
Okay, this has been a very interesting talk, judging from the interesting question. Let's thank Fabio again.